Trusted Voices is a Cognizant podcast series that aims to showcase the diversity of thoughts, backgrounds, and identity of our 350,000 associates all over the world. Trusted Disruptors is a special mini-series where we ask associates to reflect specifically on what it takes to build trust in the age of AI. Our focus will be on sustainability, transparency, data security, healthcare, global workforce, and more. The dialogue illustrates how we're building trust, especially when we show up diverse.
Today's topic is climate and nature. As concerns about the environment and ethical practices grow, companies that prioritize sustainable solutions are viewed as more trustworthy. This episode is divided into two parts. In the first part, our experts discuss the role AI will play in climate change and the carbon footprint of AI solutions.
But what I'd love to start by welcoming you both to the podcast. We're really thrilled to have you here to speak about trust in the age of AI and, you know, what it means to be a trusted voice when we think about AI, especially as it relates to the environment, right? I think companies that have a commitment to sustainability tend to be more trustworthy in this day and age. Before I dive into my questions, would you each just introduce yourself and share a little bit about what you do at Cognizant?
Philip Smith, I have the huge privilege of picking up your advisory business around sustainability.
I'm Steve Martin, Cisco, and I'm the global head of Cognizant Ocean.
So my first question is a pretty broad one, and I'd love to hear, you know, your both conservative and, you know, moonshot predictions. What role will AI play in addressing climate change? You know, I think we've had conversations about the potential that AI gives us to understand something like the ocean, which previously just seemed unimaginable. I can only imagine, what might it be able to do when we think about something as thorny and complex as climate change?
I just came from the environmental department or ministry in Britain, and the complexity that they're looking at, just preserving 30% of their marine environment, is staggering. And they were quite bluntly asking, how do we, even if we manage to capture all that data, how do we handle it? How do we read any sense into it? And they were speaking about they have access to both universities, research facility, non-profit, profit, all of that. But still, they would move way too slow to show why they should preserve it. And they were saying that they would be at least 3 years behind at any time giving a status. Just a status. It would be 3 years delayed. So that's, I think, that's where AI is playing a big role in managing that complexity.
Maybe take this question in three steps. There's some interesting industry stats that it might be useful to quote, and they're not ours, they're PwC statistics, but they're interesting. Their sense is that if we use AI in the climate battle, there's every possibility to abate up to 4% of global emissions, which is a chunk.
Yeah.
That's as much today as all of our marine and aviation emissions combined, by the way, to increase GDP by around $5 trillion a year, and to create, and this is really interesting if we think about the relationship between job creation and job erosion that is, you know, threatened by technology of all sorts, and create up to 40 million new jobs by 2030. So those are kind of economic, if you like, the socio-economic impacts of AI and its relationship to climate. This is literally the eve of COP. So this is going to sound clumsy, but we should go beyond climate when we look at the potential of AI. And Steve Martin started with that already. But your question, Pamela, is specific to climate. So again, kind of echoing Steve Martin's remarks, you know, it brings the vast capacity to analyze enormous and, of course, very complex data sets, both quickly and accurately. And that means we can identify patterns and optimize complex systems, which otherwise we wouldn't be able to do. And that enables us to make better decisions around, you know, what are very complex decisions in the sustainability space, whether, for example, it's around energy efficiency or how we can optimize grids to, you know, improve the relationship between supply and demand and grid balancing, which, of course, enables us to bring more volumes of renewable energy onto those grids. These are incredibly complex things, but without that enormous asset, it would be very difficult for us. Before we go off climate, you were talking to me yesterday, Steve Martin, about some of the advances in modeling, which will enable us to predict climate patterns and weather patterns much more accurately. And this, of course, has bearing for both policymakers and businesses that we think about our adaptation footprint, you know, our climate adaptation. Do you want to say anything more about climate?
So recent advances have brought winter forecasting 10 days ahead into a state where we can now be 99.7% more accurate anywhere given on the Earth, and really up to the stratosphere. So it's really amazing. And it's taking, it's actually going back to the first point I made, it's taking data learning from data and AI on top of it. Mm-hmm. There's no human modeling. So they're not anymore hindered by the fact that we have to make constructs.
Right.
It's data really informing itself. Sounds a little bit audacious as well, and a bit, maybe a little bit dangerous. But in this case, it's running very precisely, and they've been already utilizing it in real life, so we know it's not just a fad.
Mm-hmm.
And then that we can use again to predict near-term and long-term problems arising because of the climate crisis, making more resilient choices for the businesses, but also perhaps doing and identifying more problems that we can create the interventions for.
And I think this is, regrettably, this is incredibly important, Anna, because yeah, at the moment, we are, without wishing to sound like a bit of a doom monger, again, on the eve of the COP's COP28 starting.
But, you know, we're already at something of the order of 1.2 degrees.
We peaked at 2 degrees above pre-industrial averages in November this year. 2023 is going to be a crazy, crazy year.
Mm-hmm.
And let's not forget that that's in the context of, you know, an aspiration to achieve, you know, staying well below 1.5 degrees and certainly below 2 degrees, of course. So, you know, we're already at 1.2 degrees. So countries all over the world, not just low-lying states, not just small island states, but countries all over the road, I think, of the world, are thinking about the impact of climate change, the ability to use AI to model weather patterns and enable them to become more prepared for those changes is, you know, is, well, it's the difference between life and death. So, I mean, because the other thing which we're obviously very excited by is the opportunity to use AI in things like biodiversity and habitat loss. And we've been speaking about this in other contexts already. So, you know, by deploying AI, we can piece together and interrogate huge and complex data sets to understand how habitats are changing and enable us to limit our impact on biodiversity. Believe it or not, it's already being used to assess the recyclability of both existing and innovative materials, so we can think about how we can improve our waste and resource efficiency practices. And if that wasn't enough, you know, it also enables better public health. We can both detect and predict higher levels of both atmospheric and freshwater contamination, for example, so that we can enable policymakers and organizations to limit the impact on public.
To that point, because I think as we use AI to understand ecosystems, biodiversity, how things are tied together and truly an ecosystem, I think we'll rediscover why there's useful, why they're useful for us,
mm-hmm.
why they can rediscover medicine. Mm-hmm. I'm sure there are a lot of things that's already there that we just aren't aware of because we haven't looked at it in a very singular way. And I think that's what we're going to see. We're going to see knowledge and insights that makes it much more tangible for why we need to preserve some of these ecosystems, some of these habitats, and so on and so forth, both from an economic standpoint, but also, of course, to survival.
So AI is not only going to help us start to solve some of these problems, it's actually going to help us understand the complexity of some of these problems and maybe uncover, you know, new paths for us, which is really exciting. But shifting gears a little bit, I read a really interesting statistic in preparing to talk to you both today that came from the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. And they talk about the fact that the training process for a single AI model actually emits about 700 pounds of carbon dioxide, right? So AI in and of itself has a carbon footprint. And so I'm wondering, you know, one of the things that I know that Cognizant also does is help our customers, our clients, to reduce their carbon footprints. We have carbon calculator tools and things that we do. Do we have an AI, you know, model that is also eco-friendly, or do we foresee one in our roadmap that will also help our clients to reduce their carbon at the same time?
Well, I'm not aware of any model per se that will take that anywhere and everywhere, but there are certainly, to your point, when it comes to AI and data centers and their likes, that there are models like that. that already look at how they can balance the way they use it and everything else. But it actually is an interesting point, and this is the days of Gen AI, where responsibility, with AI is a topic, but also the responsibility of the energy consumption that's used. And I believe OpenAI themselves have addressed that ChatGPT and so like cannot be run the way it's run today because it's just consuming way too much energy. And they don't really have a solution for that at hand, as we know at the moment. Looking at data centers and the production behind all that, there's been a massive use of machine learning for quite some years, actually.
Yeah.
And some of the hyperscalers are much better than others, showing where they're getting their energy, how they're using it for renewable, and how they're balancing their grid and usage of it. I think we're going to see the need of new energy in that sector as well. As a cause of AI, since it's consuming so much energy, that's kind of pivot maybe even hyperscalers into being energy suppliers of later settings.
So maybe kind of two thoughts on that, Pamela. I mean, the first thing to say is that wherever possible, the models that we're using are tried and tested. So, and we redeploy those models wherever possible rather than building new ones. And that sort of, that, if you like, that that reuse principle is pretty much underpinning all of our development work. So first thing first, you know, we're reusing those models wherever that's possible to do. But I think the second thing to say is that's in the context of a sort of framework of low code and low impact development that we ought to just to kind of look at a little bit more carefully, and one that we ought to be fairly proud of. I say fairly because we can always learn and we must continue to learn. But, you know, we have this proprietary calculator. It helps to assess our emissions in all the work we do, both internally and, of course, for our clients. When we get an RFP, we assess, based on the scope of work, what we think that emissions footprint is going to look like. We then track actual emissions during the delivery of that program. And what that means is that we can go back to our own estimation techniques and to say just how accurate they were or they weren't. The calculator allows us to go back to our clients and recommend proactively how we might take out carbon from either their own estate or indeed of the estate that we might for them. This is the thing I'm really proud of. We then publish our own emissions data and we benchmark that so that we can learn from others, which I think is, I like that transparency for me is really important. So that proprietary tool and that framework is something we should be really proud of. I understand that it's going through a nice round of further improvement right now. So for example, we're building service-specific sustainability best practice at a kind of project archetype level so that we know more easily what a particular project is likely to consume. We're doing that in application development, in infrastructure operations, and in data management and reporting. Now, this is really cool because it just demonstrates the client centricity that underpins this. What we're also doing is refreshing the measurement model so that we can enable it to more easily align to our clients' measurement and reporting regime and to the roadmaps that they are themselves pursuing. So I think there's every indication that we've got a fit-for-purpose framework which is continually being assessed and revised to stay in the best practice.